Our sponsor today is none other than our Patreon members. You folks are bringing swords and HEMA to listeners worldwide, so thank you. To support our work and receive exclusive benefits, visit patreon.com/swordwomen. Welcome to By the Sword, where we discuss the modern study of historical European martial arts, or HEMA, with instructors, experts, and martial artists from all over the world. In episode 4 of Swords and Mental Health, I speak to regular guest Jonata Tarhan and also Kirsten Meredith, both members of True Edge Academy in Utah, USA. We discuss the topic of resilience versus persistence in the context of mental health. The episode was recorded 6 September 2021. Welcome to Swords and Mental Health, the podcast where we talk about how historical European martial arts affects our mental health and vice versa. My guests today are Jonata Tarhan and Kirsten Meredith of True Edge Academy in Utah, USA. Welcome both.
Hello.
Thank you.
Hello. So thank you so much, both of you, it's the Frana show, as we say.
It's for me. Welcome to the Frana show.
Glad to be here.
We've invited you, Kirsten. Kirsten is an instructor at True Edge, and Jonna is one of your students. And we're all HEMA friends, and we have our lives inside and outside of the HEMA community. And we all just like got talking about this topic of mental health and stuff and how it affects us. So it's great to have you both here. Something that you brought up, I'd like to ask you to sort of talk about, Kirsten, is resilience and persistence. So that's something that we can explore. There's a difference between those two concepts.
Yeah, so the way I like to think about it and the way that it's kind of characterized itself in my life is that for a very, very long time, I was persistent. And for me, that was fine, it worked out, but then I didn't realize how much of a toll being persistent was taking on the rest of my life. Right. Because persistence can be just like I was mentioning earlier, it's like a brick wall. Mm-hmm. You can be persistent like a brick wall, but everything is going to sort of wear you down over time, and it may not even be things wear you down, it's like erosion, right? There's plenty of, you've seen a nicely eroded brick wall. Eventually things versus resilience, it's like being able to absorb the thing that is troubling you, or, you know, being able to bounce back from whatever is kind of blowing through your life at the moment. So for me, I for a very long time, I was persistent, and I just fought against things, but I wasn't resilient, and I didn't know I wasn't resilient yet until the walls finally started cracking and things just started falling apart.
Mm-hmm. There's the sort of commonality between those two terms, resilience and persistence, is endurance, isn't it? So it's like the word endure, I mean, I'm a bit of a word geek, but it's to remain. It means to remain hard or firm. And it's like there's this connotation with persistence, that, you know, you just keep on keeping on no matter what. Some things do matter, don't they? So that's where the resilience comes in. The resilience sort of, it seems to imply a flexibility, a give and take. Right. Being able to bend and be more fluid, whereas persistence is like that brittleness, you know, something that just remains there, but is ultimately, you know, like you say, worn away by continued pressures. So, I mean, Jonna, you've experienced struggles in your life, which we've talked about here in previous mm-hmm. podcasts. How yes. has resilience and persistence, you know, how have those two sort of, like we can say they're almost like, you know, commonly confused for one another. How have those two things sort of cropped up in your, on your journey?
Well, definitely since we're like using metaphors, it's, yeah. Bruce Lee said, be like water, right? Mm-hmm. And when you think about like, you know, Kirsten was talking about erosion and all that, mm-hmm. Like, and then we talk about flexibility, resilience is more like water because, mm-hmm. you know, it forms like all of these like crazy canyons and it doesn't like, it wears it down. Like it takes the shape of whatever it's in.
Mm-hmm.
And, but it's like, there's so much power in water.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kind of like, I've been more resilient than persistent in my life. And it's only because I have always had to adapt in order to survive.
Mm-hmm.
And that's always like served me pretty well. It's made me, I mean, up until I started going to therapy and, you know, I've learned things, I've learned to deal with things more healthily.
Mm-hmm.
Resilience has always been for me, like, how am I going to adapt to this struggle? How am I going to adapt to, like, what are the things I'm going to tell myself mm-hmm. so that I'll be able to, like, get through it? Like, mm-hmm. you know, when I was living in the Philippines, life as a woman is not very easy. You know, when I was back home. And so I've always had to, like, tell myself, like, you know, if I'm going through something or I've just experienced a really awful situation, I'd be like, okay, well, it's not going to last long. It's going to be, you know, it's going to be different. It's not going to be forever. That's like the kind of like path of like resiliency I've always like put myself through
mm-hmm.
in order for me to just like keep going because I've always like, there's always like something that's happening in my life as you know by now. but yeah, like in terms of, yeah, resiliency, like, you know, it's always about like, you know, knowing like where you, like what you can control and like how far you can like push yourself, at least for me, like, but that took like a while for me to figure out, like I'm still figuring it out, like I've like been pushed to the limit like this year too. I thought 2020 was bad, but 2021's like hold my beer, so. But
well, I think the like this kind of this topic of mental sorts of mental health grew out of as a result of the pandemic, because the pandemic is like the sort of final, is like the icing on the cake really, on top of all the sort of things that we've had to endure in recent years, so it's kind of like brought, you know, these topics up so that we are finally discussing mental health openly and without taboo and all the rest of it. But there's a word in there that you would, when you were describing your experiences, Jana, that stuck out to me was the word adapt.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that is kind of the key to resilience is adaptation, where persistence seems to imply remaining the same, do the same thing, the same.
Yeah.
I think, and you said in our sort of chat, Kirsten, that resilience is about the recovery to normal, whatever that is, and persistence is the sort of the degradation over time under stress. Mm-hmm. When did you sort of in your experience make that change, that sort of change from one to the other?
Oh goodness, probably about my mid-20s when I realized I really needed to go to therapy. Mm-hmm. Isn't therapy great? Because I it was literally like that, very much that bootstraps mentality, right? We always hear about this, you know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, what everybody forgets to mention is that that's actually a phrase for an impossibility. You cannot accomplish that action under normal earthen physics. it's just not something you can do. But especially in, I'm not sure how persistent this is maybe in the UK, but in the US, like a lot of the like American dream ideal is sort of built up around this kind of idea that you know, you don't have help. You have to do everything by yourself. Like pull yourself up by your own bootstraps and you just get things done and you just persist and you persist. And it wasn't until I basically stepped, like I managed to seek therapy within my university system. Mm-hmm. And I went to my appointment and I was barely in the door before I was just weeping waterfalls.
Right.
Because like I finally had a person I felt I could talk to about my struggles and about this mountain of persistence I put up with in all areas of my life, right? The social, the work, the school. You know, I'm a child of the, you know, I'm a millennial, essentially. I'm 33 now. Mm-hmm. And when I graduated, it was 2006, and so I went into college, and by 2007, 2008, the entire world economy was crumbling down around us.
Yep.
And so, I worked through school, and, like, I got through these things, but, like, I'd never really truly addressed my struggles along the way. I just persisted. So like literally the wall came down in therapy and just every, like it must have been held together by spit and twine by then because it just like utterly, and my poor therapist was like, oh my goodness, this girl. I ended up actually, I think being a fairly easy patient for her because I was ready. I was so ready to just like let go of the persistence and figure out where I could actually give myself some credit. Mm-hmm. That was a big thing. It was like the whole self-worth and self-esteem aspect of it. I wasn't willing to give myself credit for being persistent.
Mm.
And that's, I think, a little bit where we come back to the talk of being resilient.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you are willing to kind of give yourself that credit for your achievements, then I think you can be a little bit more resilient over time. But if you deny yourself those credits, you end up in therapy like me.
It's so interesting that you said something. Oh, I'm sorry, Fran.
No, go for it.
It was just interesting that you said that you were an easier patient for your therapist because you were ready, because it was the same experience for me. I went to therapy and I was just like, I knew my whole life that there was something in me that was going on that was not healthy and that was affecting my life, but I had no tools on how to manage it. And so when I finally also went to therapy, I was ready too. I was so ready that like every single session also was like the floodgates were open. I was just crying every single session, but like it got to the point where I like did a few of them, and I wasn't in therapy for long until my therapist was like, I don't really have anything to show you anymore, because I was just like, I was ready to, I just absorbed everything that they showed me, everything that they taught me, all of the process, like I never resisted any of it, and I came out of that experience like a totally different person with a totally different understanding of myself. Mm, and again, it was because of that readiness, that willingness to say, okay, I need to change something because I know that something needs to be changed in the way my life is going and the way I think.
Mm.
Right.
I mean when we go to therapy, it's because we just don't have any answers, I guess. We're stuck.
Yeah.
And we want them to give us answers. And it's like, what do I do? You know, I've been trying, I've been persisting with this strategy and it's not worked. What do I do?
Yeah.
And like you say, like the answer is to sort of so get through, endure struggles is resilience and that adaptation and like that changing things, you know, just doing the same thing over and over again doesn't work. So you know, you've got to make changes. It's like, you know, if we can make this a HEMA sort of metaphor now, it's like this technique isn't working, you know, the technique must be wrong. Like, you know, no, you need to change it, you need to tweak it, you need to make, you know, you need to make changes and adapt. And something I was just thinking of, that when you were both talking about that point where you reach that breaking point where you're like, you're ready to like go to therapy and like just absorb whatever it is they're giving you, there's no kind of process of like, what is it, you know, what is getting to me, well, I know what is getting to me, let's deal with it kind of thing. But all that time where you're persisting and going through your struggles, it's a survival mode, and in survival mode you don't give a thought to things like you say, like giving credit to yourself and reflecting on how things are going. You're just trying to get through it. You're just getting through. You know, like the persisting, like you're like, I'm using so many metaphors today. You're digging through this rock or whatever. I'm just trying to get through it. And you're not paying any heed to yourself and your needs and your, you know, how things are affecting you, because that's what survival is. And I think with the pandemic and everything, all of us have just been surviving everything, literally, a lot of some people's cases. And it's the time to be really kind to yourself. And when you were saying like, oh, you know, I can't, Kirsten, you were talking about, you know, giving credit to yourself. My strategy for giving myself credit for things is to stop feeling guilty by, you know, not viewing myself as me, but viewing myself as a friend that I know. So that's what I do. Like, when I'm talking about myself or viewing my things that I've gone through, I don't think I'm me, Fran. I think I'm talking about Jana or someone. Like, you know, I would never deny that person their credits. I would never, I would never withhold, you know, think of all the incredible things that person's done. I would never hold that back from them. How could I be so cruel? Why would I do that? So that's my kind of personal script flip strategy for dealing with that. I don't know, what kind of things have you two done to sort of be more kind and gentle with yourself?
Oh boy.
big question.
Yeah.
I do a lot of mindfulness.
Yeah.
That's the way I like went with my therapy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's I practice loving kindness. And so loving kindness is basically, you know, you start with you know, saying kind things about yourself and telling yourself that, you know, you're safe, you're loved and all that. There's like a whole like chant for it. And then like you extend it to, you know, someone that you care about, someone that maybe you don't like, someone you don't know. And it's the same script.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, and one of the things that like I learned during therapy is, it's so much easier to be kind to yourself and to be kind to others than holding on to the anger and, you know, the hurt and the resentment.
Mm-hmm.
Because like a part of my my survival, like throughout my life up to like the point where I started therapy, was not forgetting things that happen to me when I can remember them, because my memory is shit, especially with traumatic events. But things that I can remember to like not like hold on to them so that it doesn't happen to me again. Like if I like back then, my logic was, if I have all of the like these information and memories in my head, I can go back to it and use it as a reference for when something shitty happens to me again. And I can use that. But that was like the unhealthy way. It got me through a lot, but then it was like that thing where it was wearing me down mentally. Like it got to the point where I was in my 20s and I was just like bawling all the time. Like I would have like meltdowns out of nowhere because I was getting like flashbacks because I keep holding on to these memories and not processing them well. And so, you know, a lot of it, you know, later on when I learned how to cope with things in a healthier manner was, you know, letting things go and like making a path for kindness, not just for myself, but like to others. And it's not just, and everything that I do is not, you know, if I'm kind to someone, if I forgive someone, it's not for them. It's for myself. It's a reflection of when it all goes back to me. And, you know, like forgiving someone, forgiving people who've hurt me, forgiving people who has done like really crappy things in the past. Like they don't have to know, they don't have to hear it from me. But the fact that I'm saying to myself that I've forgiven them, or I'm past whatever hurt that has been, you know, done to me, like helps me a lot because, again, it's for me. Like whatever I do is a reflection of who I am and not that person. So that's kind of like my little thing on that. Kirsten, it's your turn.
No, I'm just processing what you were just saying because it feels so familiar. because I think what I realized most, in, I didn't have to continue some of the behavioral patterns I grew up with.
Right.
The self or the very persistent self-reliance, whilst not bad in most cases, was something that was very much imprinted on me from my family when I was a kid. And you know, I've always watched the people around me work very, very hard, but maybe not be very, very open about their struggles. And like, I never watched the emotional labor, and I don't know how many, you know, people in my life actually undertook the emotional labor they should have when I was growing up. Because like, personally, I, you know, I'm the child to a pretty young mom. My mom didn't expect to have me at 21. So like, she worked very, very hard all of her life. My, you know, all my parents worked very, very hard to provide for us. I was provided for by grandparents, you know, so like, the idea that, you know, some of those behavioral patterns didn't have to continue through me. I didn't have to eventually, you know, being able to manage one's anger and one's struggles and having, you know, going through and processing that and being able to, you know, not be reactionary, right? Again, kind of that sense of meditation, right? You can choose whether or not you actually react to the emotions you're feeling. And that was the biggest tool for me, was just realizing those patterns in my life, and then being able to choose to, you know, to, like Jonna said, to forgive is probably one of the biggest tools and probably one of the hardest things to do. Whether that's yourself, whether that's the people around you, those that hurt you, those that helped you, or those that hurt you even though they were trying to help you. And maybe didn't know that they were hurting you. You know, and it's just being able to look at those things and decide to grow better.
What I really love about the time that we're in now is that there are words for things that we didn't have before, like when we were growing up, things that things that weren't discussed, probably because even the people, the adults around us acting in ways that we've taken on didn't have vocabulary for things, like you said, like Kirsten, like emotional labor is a word that didn't enter my vocabulary until like 2 years ago. And it's probably still alien to a lot of folks what that means. Like, you know, it's something that we do And when I say we, I mean 50% of the population do more than the other 50%.
Yes.
And it's something that we do. It's invisible, but it is there. And we don't, we're not even aware of how much we do it, I think, a lot of the time. And the other word that kind of that goes way back into antiquity that we all do know, that is sort of tacked onto this conversation, is stoicism. And it's that stoicism that kind of fuels that behavior that of, you know, the people around us teaching us ways to be like, you know, just keep, I think in the UK, I can't remember who it was, but there's a phrase, just keep buggering on. I mean, just keep at it, whatever it is, keep doing it. There's a very famous poster that came out of the UK, keep calm and carry on. That's been turned into so many posters and memes, and it was apparently created by the government for the eventuality that we were invaded by the Germans and occupied, and they were gonna put these posters everywhere to tell everyone keep calm and carry on, you know, that bulldog British spirit, just get on with life, it's no big deal, the Germans are here, we're just gonna get on with it. You know, that kind of stoicism, you know, which got people through wars. Again, it's a survival thing. Yeah. But it left its mark. It left its, you know, its PTSD stain on people. And you've got that kind of generational trauma coming down. Like, people who were affected by things like that, you know, it passes on to their kids, and their kids take on these attitudes of like, you know, let's just keep at it. But the fact that there was this whole taboo around mental health up until like recent years, this taboo about talking about our struggles, you know, what we're actually really going through in life, means that we take on all of that struggle internally. We blame ourselves. We end up in therapy. You know,
absolutely. Mm-hmm. Especially when you think about like just putting in an intersection of like immigration too. I don't remember the exact numbers, but I was reading this study before in terms of like Asian Americans and immigrants in particular, the type of like mental health services that they get and that they actually take, and it's a very low number.
I imagine.
And a lot of that is also culturally, like, you know, Fran didn't really grow up in the Philippines, but coming from that kind of cultural background, the idea of mental health is so taboo as well. Like, nobody talks about it. Mm. It's a source of so much shame.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you say, oh, yeah, I'm dealing with, you know, like, anxiety and depression and all that, like, I didn't know any of these words until I came to this country, because we don't talk about that. I didn't know that my mother was stonewalling me every time she was upset about something. And, you know, it was like those things that I like learned later on, like you were saying, I did not have the language for, but I knew like that what they were doing was something that was affecting me. I just didn't know what it was. And a lot of the things that, you know, I could see myself kind of doing was also like partly like I was mirroring the coping mechanisms that my family, especially the women in my family, were doing. There was a lot of silence, especially with the women in my family. There's a lot of silence. And so I don't know, like what Kirsten was saying, I don't know the amount and how much effort they put forth to like deal with whatever it was that they, because I knew they were dealing with other things, like I can tell, like now that I'm looking back at like their behaviors and the way they've like gone through life, I knew that there was a lot more internally that they were going through, but it was never discussed. I could only see like little like specks of it here and there by their like actions and stuff, but they're like a lot of it, the majority of it growing up, it was all silence, especially with the women. And so like now that I'm like where I am, and this is why I'm the way I am, is because I do not want that. Like I am Like the I always tell people like who I am and how I present myself is like everything against like what my family wants me to be, and like in terms of like societal norms and like heteronormativity with like how women are supposed to be back home, or at least what I was raised, like, you know, the idea of what a woman is supposed to be. It's like between like my physical appearance and the way I behave is the total opposite of all of that, because there is n it, it was it's a prison for it's oppressive, and it is limiting the kind of culture I grew up in.
Keep yourself small.
Yeah.
Don't take up space. Don't impose yourself on people. Be nice, smile, be
Exactly.
pleasant, all that kind of classic female oppression, basically.
Exactly.
That's something that I sort of witnessed, like growing up as a child of a Filipino immigrant. Also, that attitude is quite prevalent throughout the
Yeah.
community.
Oh,
And
yeah.
another sort of source of shame, that thinking about sort of like our background and our community and that kind of source of shame, is asking for help, whether
Yes. Oh, yeah.
or help.
Ah, oh, let's get into
Let's get into
that,
that.
baby.
When you said like the folks, the Asian American folks weren't taking up the offer of mental health support, that because of the mental health stigma, that's a failure. You failed if you're doing something like that. Another sort of, we were talking about the stereotype of like every Filipino has three jobs, right?
Yeah.
Is like you never get so you never ask for help,
Oh, yeah.
financially. You'd never ever go, on the dole or something like that. You would all, you have to just, keep have that work Catholic work ethic type thing. Just
Yeah.
work your way out of poverty, and it will come.
Yep.
It's
I have
like,
a question, actually,
yeah.
real quick. Okay, so for both of you, if this applies, okay, so like give a time estimate for how long it took you to actually get to therapy from the point you realized you might need to go to therapy. How long did it actually take you to process that? I would say I would probably estimate it took me probably close to 2 or more years.
Mine took longer than that. And I think it's because I was foreign to the concept of going to therapy. Like, I had never heard of it until I lived here. And so I knew that it was a path that I needed to take, but like actually like getting the resources and like having an idea where to go and how to do it was like
That's hard.
it felt like a mountain to climb. Like when I it took me to the point where I was in the lowest point of my life, I was thinking about wanting to die. Like I hit that point where I was, what do you call it, ideation or something?
Suicidal ideation? Yes.
Yeah, I got to that point, and my ex was talking about committing me instead of helping me. He was like, no, I'm gonna find somewhere to, like, he was talking to my friend who's a nurse, and my friend was like, yeah, he was asking me about options and how to commit you. And I was like, okay, that's not good. And that was like the point where I'm like, okay, I need to figure this out. But like I had to like do it all by myself, but like it got to that point. So I'm talking about, I think where I think it took me about like 5 years before I got to that point. 'Cause like I was like, this happened 2009. I went to therapy like 2019, and I was already like in my 30s. And yeah, and I know that between my mid to late 20s, I already had this idea that I knew something was going on in my head from all of the trauma and all of the, you know, bad stuff that's happened to that. I've never, like, I had to process, but like, I know that I wasn't processing it properly, that it was starting to like come out. So it took me about 5 years. to get to that point. And it took like being scared of being committed for me to actually do it. And again, not knowing, not having any kind of like, not having any kind of like reference or like someone to model after. Because again, my family doesn't talk about that stuff. I've no one in my, I'm the first person in my family to ever receive therapy, I'm pretty sure.
Oh yeah, no, I'm pretty
So
sure. Yeah.
I for me it's kind of a case of I didn't realize I was in trouble until I looked back kind of thing.
Oh, yeah.
Like I when I had my first child, I think I thought, oh, I'm going through, I'm struggling, but that's because I'm a new mum. And I was on my own. And I'd never even babysat and never looked after a child before. And I was on my own looking
Oof.
after a kid, had no idea what I was doing, and was not able to make connections with the local community and lots of baby groups and things like that. It just wasn't working. I just wasn't socially functioning. And I, my kid turned out fine and and was healthy and everything, but I looking back, I was suffering from depression. I was really struggling, and because of
Yeah.
that kind of stoic belief that you have to just keep at it and persist, I kept on. And it, I should have gone into therapy then.
Yeah.
I should have got help then and said, actually, I'm really struggling, and I'm not, I. But that's the kind of like new mother pressure, which is a
Yes.
whole new
Ugh.
like another whole nother sort of layer of, you can do this kind of thing. You can be the perfect mom and keep the household together and all the rest of it. There's a huge, huge amounts of pressure,
Yeah.
and a failure is not an option. So yeah, that's another kind of that's probably the point at which I should have done, but it wasn't until. My oldest kid is like nearly 14 now. Other stuff happened along the way, obviously, but that was the point at which I should have started to get help. Please, please, can I have some
Oh,
help?
absolutely. If I had to mark mine down, it would be like, yeah, mid-teens. Mid-teens, I should have been talking this through with somebody, but it wasn't until my mid-20s I finally made it to therapy.
Yeah,
So
yeah.
yeah, 10
I
years.
postpartum depression is no joke.
Yeah.
Like it's so sinister. Like, because I went through the same thing too. Like I thought about wanting to die and like taking my baby with me. That's how bad it was. And like it's kind of like what you were saying, like that idea of like perfection as a mother. And that's like that again, that goes back to like the way, our heteronormative like institutions are set up. Like the idea of a mother is an institution.
Yeah.
Like, 'cause every single experience, every single womanly experience is different. And like having that standard was it's hard. Like I was I'm a young mom. I had my child when I was 20. So it's been hard because I did not want this pregnancy. I love my kid to death. Like I she they are the source of my I'm very proud of them, but given the chance of like actually having a choice, there's so much pressure in being a mother. Like I wanted to give up my kid for adoption because terminating the pregnancy was not an option I was given. And so I had to go through it, which was a traumatic experience on its own. But I wanted, I didn't know what I was doing. Like I was a child myself. Like I've been sheltered up to that point. And so I'm like, how am I supposed to be responsible for another human being? So I was gonna put my kid up for adoption and a family member was gonna take her, take them. But my mother talked me out of it. And from that point on, like it felt like all of the responsibility fell on me because I felt like I made that decision. But then again, I was very young when I did. And now that I'm looking back, like they made me feel like it was my responsibility now because I said, okay, yes, I'm going to do it. And it goes back to that. I can't ask for help because I chose this.
Yeah.
Mm.
You know?
Back to that persistence. But you adapted and you were resilient and you're a great mom.
Not without like having help from people though.
Exactly.
You know?
And that's
so hard. Like, you know, again, coming from that mentality, it's so hard to like accept and receive help from others because like that mentality of like if you accept help, you've failed. That means that you could make it on your own. But like also like going back to what Kristen was saying earlier about like pulling yourself up by the bootstraps, that is like such an American concept that like shocked me to my core when I first moved here. Cause like, you know, Filipino culture has its toxic traits, but like what I like love the most about our culture is that the sense of community is very strong.
Yeah.
And the idea of like this American hyper individualistic like mindset like blows my mind. And so and I've lived this kind of like I've tried to embody this mindset for the longest time, but it never worked for me. Like especially as a single mother, as a woman of color, like it's never been good for me to I've always needed some kind of support, some kind of help. And then like with all of the recent stuff that's been happening to me, like the community that I've landed myself in, I was like, how am I supposed to like repay all of these people? Like they're just helping me so much. And then like when we had that, we were chatting recently and you're like, no, just that's how it is when you want, but yeah, it's like it's I'm on the receiving end of the kindness I've given to people in the past.
Yeah.
That people couldn't reciprocate. Mm-hmm. Like I was like, this is how it feels to be on the receiving end of the kindness I've given to people.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's like it blows my mind because like in the back of my head, like every single time I'd be like, how am I supposed to repay Kristen? How am I supposed to repay my friend, my other friend? How am I supposed to repay Fran? Like, but then again, like I'm like I had to like step back and because one of my friend's wife, we were chatting and she was like, it's a trauma response.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, that's right.
Yep. If you've grown like, up in an environment that makes you feel like you are indebted for everything happens to you,
yeah,
you can't shake that very easily.
Exactly. And that's correct because in Filipino culture there is the concept called utang na loob, which is debt of gratitude. So every time somebody does something for you, and this is like so prevalent in my family that it's like the source of a lot of toxic problems that I've had with everybody in my family. It's that concept. And it's so strong in Filipino culture. But yeah, it's in me too. And so I've always had to like, you know, remind myself, like when I do kind things for people, for the people that are my friends and the people I care about, I never do it because I want something in return. And so I'm kind of like applying that logic. Okay, when somebody does something nice for me, I'm going to say, okay, that's how they feel too.
Yeah.
That they just want to be kind to me and they have no ulterior motives, you know?
Seriously, I had to have the behavior modeled by other selfless friends before I became okay with feeling like I was worthy to have that, I guess, attention paid to my well-being.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense? That's a loaded statement.
Yes. Very
loaded statement. No, it makes sense. It makes a lot of sense. But,
and then it was another revelatory thing to be like, it's okay to also feel that way and be that way toward other people. Because like something I mentioned to Jonna, especially like this last, you know, month or so of hectic life, is that like I decided to try and be to her the friend that I needed like 7 years ago.
Right.
Where it's like I didn't have anybody. I had no community. Gosh, Hema is such a great thing because it's given me so much. Like, I had to make that conscious choice to be like, ah, hell no, this isn't gonna go down the same way that it did for me, because like no one should have to really go through that. Like, yeah. And especially if you, you know, you've seen other people model that behavior for you and they become like your hype person. And like, they're like, I'm going to bring the energy to this. We're going to get it done. And, you know, that's part. So like to really bring it back, that's what being part of HEMA has been for me.
Mm-hmm.
Finding those people with like, just the aggressively selfless, like, here's my body, train with it, right? Like,
yeah, for sure.
Handle my board, play with this, you know. It's that aggressive, like, trust and, like, selflessness. Mm-hmm. That, like, okay, this is a model unto which I can be much happier living my life on, rather than... feeling guilty for not being good enough all the time ever.
Mm-hmm, yeah. I mean, the reason like we've kind of been drawn to swords, this weird kind of combination of swords and mental health, how do those two things come together? What's the connection? And the connection is community, because when our mental health suffers, it's almost always because of lack of support from outside, either because we're not getting it or we refuse to ask for it.
Right.
And in the HEMA community, I think a lot of us are just stunned by how supportive that, like you say, aggressively supportive the HEMA community is. You're like, they won't let you refuse their help in a lot of cases. Yeah. And it kind of, you will not refuse my help. I'm going to help you. And that's that. So it's that, like, oh yeah, I need other people in order to be healthy and survive. You know, it's I can't pull myself up by my bootstraps. Like you say, that is on in earth and physics. That's not going to work. That's what other people do. Other people build us up, and we help ourselves. But, you know, so when someone else is down, like you say, past Kirsten needed that friend, and then you see modern day Jana is that sort of reflection of that. Like, I'm gonna help her out because that's what I needed. So that's how community works. There's a thing we were gonna talk about, you know, that not allowing yourself to enjoy joy. Like when stuff does go right for you, and like it's almost like when someone does, like, to just sort of connect it to what we were just talking about, when people help you, there's almost like a, you would do that for me without any kind of expectation of something in return. You really would. And it's that, you know, that's not allowed, you know, because I'm not worthy of that. I don't deserve that. Why would you do that for me? Of course we would do that for other people though, right? A drop of a hat. Of course we would. Yeah. You know, the two things like don't make sense together. But when we're kind of like in that mindset of I don't deserve this, or I can't mentally accept this person's help because, you know, I think there's something behind it, there's some ulterior motive or whatever. There's also that kind of aspect when we're enjoying something, like things are going well for us sometimes and we're in a joyful situation, but we don't completely embrace it, we don't completely surrender to that joy, because we're at the back of our minds waiting for it to end, waiting for it all to go wrong, and that period of joy to sort of finish.
Trauma responds.
Yay! Yeah, we're waiting, like I think you said, Jenna, we're waiting for the other shoe to drop. So the term for that that came up is dress rehearsing for tragedy. So Kirsten, let's talk about that for a bit.
Oh goodness. Dress rehearsing for tragedy. I feel like that's just legitimately, it's anxiety in a nutshell. Right?
Yeah, and it is
imposter syndrome in a nutshell. It's so many things that, you know, when you're future focused and you can't kind of enjoy what you're experiencing in the now, like you're just anticipating something. You don't know what. You know, you can't really predict something, but you're just anticipating the fact that it's like, you know, obviously something has to go wrong. Nothing can ever be this great or this perfect or this nice.
What's the catch? Right.
What's exactly. the catch? Yes. Yeah. And, you know, and again, like you said, it's trauma response, right? If you grow up in, you know, maybe if you grow up in an environment where something is always tied to a debt, or you're made feel guilty for, I don't know, existing, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, it's not like as if it was your choice to become a human on this earth. Yeah. You were brought here and then suddenly you have a debt to repay for it. Yeah. I don't know. I that was one of the big things that, again, therapy really helped with, is like being able to slow down and credit the moment and kind of put a little bit of a stopper into the whole trying to predict whether things were going to go bad in the future.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You mentioned a book, Kirsten.
Yes, I did.
A kid's book.
One of the most adorable things my partner does is he doesn't have kids yet, but he will read bedtime stories to one of his good friend's kids when we go over for like a nightly board gaming session. So he helped put the small ones to bed, right? And it's so adorable. But one of the books that they rented from the library this last time was called I'm Worried. And it was literally anxiety in a nutshell, because it was about a worried little potato. Literally just very worried, and was trying to explain to his friends, which were a little girl and a flamingo, about how they were just so worried about how things could happen to them. And it got to the point where, like, the potato could convince the flamingo that bad things might happen, and they literally wrapped themselves up in bubble wrap. To try and anticipate bad things happening to them in the future. And of course, the bubble wrap had them completely immobilized, right? They couldn't do anything. They were so wrapped up in their own worry, they could not get anything accomplished. And thankfully, the little girl was there to help talk some reflective sense into them, but they managed to get through it. And it was a very, like, very easy to understand. And I kind of wish someone had given me that book when I was, you know, a young child, because it was it's still very important as an adult.
Yeah, that sounds like a really good book, and I realize that we're all just worried little potatoes going through life.
So yeah, go on, Jana.
I was just talking about, like, it just going off of, like, you know, the idea of, like, it's just anxiety, and it is, like, I grew up, you know, just having, like, one bad experience after another. And so my whole life has just been, I didn't realize it. I was just on survival mode my whole life. And I, you know, I didn't realize how bad it is for you to be on that mode all the time. But it was a way for me, you know, anticipating what's going to happen next, and then know it was going to be bad, because, like, you know, that's all the model I've ever had, like, throughout my childhood. Mm. And so, and it's the things that I've seen and the things that I've experienced. And so just anticipating that, and, like, dress rehearsing for tragedy, as we've said, like, it's the way that I've been able to, like, survive life. But then it's not good for you. It's not healthy. And it's like what, you know, Kirsten was saying, like, wrapping yourself up in that bubble wrap, it immobilizes you. I felt like my whole life, like, I am stuck in this, like, anxious, like purgatory of, like, before I went to therapy, I have so much anxious thoughts. Like, I wasn't hearing voices, but, like, there's a lot of chatter in my brain. Like, a lot of what ifs, a lot of what happened if this happens, you know, like, what happens if, you know, this person leaves, or, like, you know, you die or something. You know, there's a lot of that. And it was like, it was so exhausting to have that going off on your brain like 24/7.
Yeah.
And when I finally went to therapy, that's when, like, one day I woke up and I was just going through my day, and I like laid in bed at the end of the day, and I was like, why is my mind so quiet? And it was like, it blew my mind. I was like, is this what it feels like to be neurotypical? Like, because I, like, this is awesome.
Oh, man. Oh, wait, it's not like having a radio constantly tuned to, like, the loudest volume setting
exactly.
running in your head at all times, and it doesn't matter what it's playing, and sometimes what it's playing is really bad for your mental health, but other times mm-hmm. it's just, like, loud music constantly going in your head. You can't shut it up ever? What?
Yeah. Like, whoa, this is mind-blowing. But, like, but also, like, one thing that you also mentioned is, like, you know, like being like aware of, like, the now and, like, not worrying too much of the future, because, like, you know, a lot of the things that, like, I was, like, constantly, like anxious about was, like, the, like, I was, like, very bad with control, like not being in control, even for the, like, the little things used to upset me, like, if something goes, like, against my plans. And I think now that I've realized that it's because of that anxiety of, like, knowing that something bad will happen. If I stray from my plan, if I stray from what I have, like, programmed my mind and, like, my day to go, if something happens, it's, like, I used to have meltdowns over it before I went to therapy, like, because it's the chatter in my head that's like, oh, no, if you deviate from your plan, everything's just going to go to shit.
Yeah,
like, it's that, like, constant, like worry in my head. And then I realized, like, when I went to therapy, one of the things that I learned the most that helped me a lot is the idea of being in the moment and, you know, understanding that, like, what is in front of you right now, like, you know, you may not be able to control all of it, but there are things that you can control, and that's the things that you need to focus on and not worry about the future, because you don't know what's going to happen in the future, you know what I mean? Like, but what's in front of you right now, like, you can, like, strategize and stuff. And that was, like, it's such a simple concept, you know? Like,
it's okay.
Like,
Donna, we try to teach people the concept of fooling all the time, and it's the same thing, right?
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
This is just sword fighting, but with your brain.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely.
Your brain.
If you try to I'm gonna bring this back to sword fighting really hard,
yes.
Because, like, if you try to predict what your opponent is gonna do, you're gonna lose, because they're not gonna do something that you expected. So
exactly.
If you actually use the concepts of sword fighting as we know them and like pay attention to the bind and fulin and all of these other cool concepts that we learn, you can react in the moment and do the thing correctly. And oh my god, look,
oh,
sword
God.
Fighting is the cure for everything.
And it's like, you don't have to seize life by the boar all the time. Because most of the time, it's the knock, you know? Like, it's the knock.
Oh my God, my instructor, that is exactly what she used to say to me. Like she said, just deal with the moment. Moment to moment. Don't worry about what's just happened. Don't worry about what's going to happen. Just deal with what's happening right now. I think there was a Japanese
term for it.
Is it still echoey?
Oh, you're good now.
No, it's good. It's gone. The fulin, dealing with the moment, is
the way to go.
Hell no.
Still here, just for some reason my headphones aren't working any longer.
Okay. So I think I'm gonna wrap it up there. We've established that dealing with the moment, living in the moment, is the key to resilience and adaptation. whether that's fencing or whether that's with our mental health and dealing with our lives. Persistence, being rigidly, just buggering on doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. It's probably not the best way to go about things. But I just want to say, Jana and Kirsten, thank you so much for joining me today.
Yes, it's always a pleasure to be in the Frana Show.
And take care of yourselves and happy training.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast. To show your appreciation, please give us a 5-star review on your podcast platform or support our work by becoming a patron at patreon.com/swordwomen. Go to @swordwomen on Instagram to see upcoming interviews or visit buythesword.net to learn about our events or visit our Facebook page, By the Sword.